Now, this is November 3rd, 1978, and I'm Rob McCandless, and I'm talking to Johnny Taku Jack. This is tape one of this day, November 3rd, 78. Johnny, now, yesterday we were talking about your early days in Atlin, and about trapping and your experiences in big game hunting for George Ball. And just when we stopped, I had started off with a question about the steamboating. How did you get into working on the steamboats? Did you know something about boats to begin with?
Oh, yeah. First of all, I was a little kid when the first I remember the boats, the old Scotia. And then later on, they had a new boat built in there. It was around 16 or 17, but the last I remember is 1918 when they extended the steamer Turon. The white people had it called it Turon, but the engineer, the carpenter engineer, that asked the old man Taku Jack, what name could they be using for that boat? Because it's built in Atlin, it's got to have a name from Atlin. He mentioned everything he could think of, and finally he think of a lake, of a little creek they call Tarahini. And the Indian way, it's got a pronouncing for that, they call him Te-ya-ha-hini. That means it's running across on top of the rocks for about a mile. It's just the bedrock where it's running, you could see the bedrock. And so they call it, they spill it out to him, and it ends up to be Tarahini. But the quick way they call it Turon. But the right name of it is Tarahini. So this engineer satisfied with it, and that's where the name come Turon in Atlin.
So your father named that boat?
Yeah. And then the same time the steamer Too Shy was built in Carcross. But the first boat was running that I could remember, it was, they call it the Galena. That was the first boat that was running in Atlin. But the years and years before, the boat was running in Atlin Lake, Tagish Lake was Australia. That's the wreckage of it laying over the place in Carcross they call the fish camp today. And you could see the old wrecking there yet.
The Australian.
Australia, yeah. So in Atlin, the boat running in Atlin, he's a captain on that. He was a Scotchman. His name was Captain MacDonald. And well, for this little part, I'm going to jump from till last summer, this when I was in Vancouver. By golly, I was surprised to meet Captain MacDonald's son. His name was MacDonald. I met him in Vancouver. He's just about the same age as I am, or a little. He might be younger than me. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I know that boat was running in Atlin. Finally, another captain took over. Captain Garvey? No. Captain, what do you call that fella used to run the Klondike? Captain Coughlin. He took them over, and when he finished two seasons there, then another captain came in, Captain Garvey. Great big fella, and at that time, Fred Vey was the diesel gas engineer, diesel I think it was, engineer in Atlin. And the mate, his name was Malcolm McCauley. He was a very nice fella. I worked with him in Atlin for one season, on the Turon. me and a white boy, young fella, his name was Albert Miller, which lately, a couple of years, two or three years ago, he died in Vancouver. So I knew Captain McKay later on. Captain McKay was in Atlin one, and I know him well, and Malcolm McCauley. So when I working in the railway in Pennington, I work under the foreman's name, Denny Costas, is a Greek guy. I put in 5 years in that area as a section worker. On the third year, he started teaching me how to race track and how to line tracks and how to shim it and how to look after the tracks in the winter time. I worked 5 years under him, and he was very strict foreman. He had fired a lot of Indian fellas, and they thought I was going to be fired at any time, the boys tell me. They always tell me, he says, gee, it's a funny thing, he said, you tell that foreman I use everything, and he always have, and you even wrestle with him, he said. Well, I told the boys, I said, when a foreman is looking after a job, he's your boss, and if you do the right thing and they like you, you couldn't help it, you can talk to him just like anybody else, because he's just a man, working man like you and I. But he's the foreman, he's the one that to tell you what to do, and you have to do it. To my surprise, I worked 5 years with him, and at the end, when he goes on holiday, I take over the section work. I race track, I line the track, we put in ties, and I even do some work on the frog, the switch frog. And I know the rules. I had a little book. He gave me a little book to steady it, so I steady that. If there's any trouble, I know what to do on a track, what kind of flags to put up, and all that thing. But my friend Billy Hall, he used to work with me up there every summer. In 5 years' time, finally, he was out trapping and he didn't get a chance to come to work. There was no opening at Pennington. I went to Whitehorse and he got the job was a deckhand on the Yukon River. One day he came to, that's the first, fifth season, Pennington. He came to Carcross, and Saturday night I was in Carcross, and he told me they need a deckhand in the Yukon River boat, steamer Exceller, freight boat. And I was interested, and at the same time, it was my old chum, he's my friend, Billy Hall, so I tell him, I said, you put my name up, but I'm going to give 30 days notice to my foreman that I'm going to quit and I'm going down the Yukon River. So I did, I put 30 days notice, and he didn't want it to let me go, but I wanted to go as a young man, I wanted to see the Yukon summer. I heard so much about Dawson City and the Klondike. So I went and I went to work. To my surprise, when I come to the steam Exceller to work, I find Malcolm McCauley, the mate that used to be on Atten, when I work under him for one season. And to my surprise, that Captain McKay was there too, and he was my father. He knew my father well. Instead of calling me Johnny or Taku or Jack, he always called me Taku, Captain McKay. So when I get on the Yukon River, at that time, that was 1926, I stay on the Yukon River 26, 27, 28, 29, up to 30.
Summer of 1932.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And while I was in Atlin, Malcolm McCullough teach me how to splice cable and how to fix the heaver lines and the big cable rope for all the quick joints, quick splicing and all that thing. I know all that. I think I can still rise a cable for a half an inch up to 2.5 inch cables. I know how to do it because I have done that for 5 seasons.
I've done that. It's hard work. You have to know what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. And then Malcolm McCullough gave me a little book that I studied at for the mate, second mate. I was studying that, and he teach me how to balance the boat and forward and aft and starboard and port side, all that thing that I know. And then they teach me how to ring the bell for go ahead and back up and slow and full speed ahead. All that thing was taught to me, and happened to be Captain McKay was the captain on the boat. He was on the 5 season on the Exceller. This boat was running from Dawson down to the coast of Alaska. So the name of the boat was Alaska. Mm-hmm. But when they transferred from Dawson City to Whitehorse, they changed the name, they reversed it. It's Alaska spelled backwards, Exceller. Mm-hmm. So when I was on that boat, McKay was there, the man that I know, and this Fred Gray and Adam, his brother was the chief engineer in that boat, steam engineer, Bill Vay. And my head mate was a little fella, his name was Tip. We used to call him Tippy, but he was a cranky little fella there. But we have to be very nice with him. He's very good with anybody that know what he's doing. I can operate. I was the steam winch man. Mm-hmm. I used to be the winch man all the time. We have trouble when some of the guys don't know anything about it. They're hoping it fall glass, and they bust good many cables. But myself, that I got onto it in this 5 seasons, so I know how to operate that. And sometimes John and Murray, he was the pilot of ours. Sometimes in the night when I finally, in the fourth year, the fourth season, Malcolm McCauley took sick, and they sent him to Skagway. That time they're working people, they go to Skagway to the hospital. At that time, Captain McKay asked Malcolm McCauley, is there any one of your men that Dick Hans here could temporarily take your place while you're to the hospital? And Malcolm and I was getting along pretty good, the second officer, so he took his cap out and they put it on my head, And that fits me, and he took off his blast button coat and tried that on, so I tried it on. And he told Captain McKay, he said, there's your man. He said, he knows everything, and you won't have no trouble with him. Well, Captain McKay looked at me and he salutes to me. Oh, I was just making the fun. He says, hi, sir. And I was standing there before him with the second mate's cap and a brass button coat. And I had jeans and tennis shoes on. But anyhow, later on, I used a full suit and temporarily waiting for them, and I had to finish out the season as a second mate. At that time, to my surprise, there was only 2 Indians who was a second mate on the Yukon River. One was Freddy Boss, and one is me, Johnny Jack. And at that time, Captain Frank Slim, an Indian fella, he can't read and write very well, but he know the Yukon River and he know the rules of the captain pilot there all the time that he was a Yukon pilot in the Yukon River. So I put in the sick in the last 5th season, I put in, I came down to the same, I was just a temporarily. But Malcolm didn't show up. I don't know what became of him. They find out that he was get a cancer, and that's it. What was the trouble? So I had this job, and in the last season, fully, I was right on a second mate job, and I try to do the best I can so that nothing goes wrong. and all the Indian boys, plenty of all the Indian boys that's working on a riverboat, and they know me well, since I've been so very nice with them when they're working, and then they try to do the best they can for me to uphold me on the job, because it's the only one Indian that's on a second mate, so they try to do the best they can for me, then I won't have no black marks on my record. But I don't know whatever happens. So when we travel at night, nothing else to do, I go up there in the pilot house and sit down with John and Mary. Sometimes plenty all in the evening they show me, tell me what to do.
Johnny Mary was the pilot?
Yeah, was the pilot. And John and Mary would sit there, him and I talking, he'd tell me, take over the wheel. He said, you've got to learn that someday, because it says whenever something goes wrong with the pilots going up, it says sick or fall over and break his leg or something, it says we've got to have somebody to teach to handle the boat. And some nights there I put here run the whole thing all night, mm-hmm. providing that John and Mary show me what to do. And in that fifth season I was on the Yukon River, I just about knew every turn there is in the Yukon River. But I wouldn't say I know it right now. There might be places that I can't recognize us, that the land is getting pretty well growing over. And that was 1930, and that's a long time ago. And I might miss a lot of places. So that's how I get on the Yukon River, because I've been a deckhand before for one season.
The Axella was a freight boat mostly?
Always.
Well, you were pulling barges too, eh?
Pushing it, yeah.
Yeah, pushing them. Or towing, or whatever they call it.
Yeah, a lot of these young fellas did laughed at me because I was a deckhand on a wood burning river boat. But they don't recognize it. We all get $60 a month. That don't mean a day, it's a month. We can work night and day, and we don't get no overtime and nothing if it's a ship work. Like if we get up one time, we got stuck on a, just above Five Finger Rapids, we got stuck on a river turn and a turn. And I was a lucky man that I wasn't on a wheel when that happened. It was before I was acting as a straw boy, a second officer. At that time, Malcolm McCullough was there, and he was the one up the wheel when that happened. And we stay on a bar there for 36 hours.
Are you going downstream or
upstream?
You're going up when you hit.
Upstream, the barge jackknife. Hmm. You see, we got a jackknife to barge around, and if it jackknifes too much, well, it goes that way.
You do that with a windlass, eh?
Windlass. I was behind the winch when that happened. He told me to go the other way, and then he told me, quick, put it back, and the river current hit it the other way, and went right back and got on the sandbar. Then we pulled the spires down, and we put it on, and we jacked that up, we tried to spar it out. And then at noon hour, we all get together, captain and me, and since I was the deck boy up there looking after the ropes and everything up there, they called me in there too, and we all agree. So Tip and I was saying that if we could only get the barge jackknife out and let the current hit it just enough, and the same time the spars we worked at, and that might lift it out. The current hit it, it's going to throw us off, but we're going to bring it right back as the word of the barge supposed to be. And we did, after 36 hours, by God, we just drift off of the sandbar. Old man Captain McKay, he gave me credit in that instead of giving the credit to others. It was just saying that was me, but it was Tip, the other fellow, suggested that in the first place, and I agree with him. Oh, we had a wonderful time, but that was a hard work. the river boat was so rough, when we go to bed in there for 1 week in the first place, we couldn't sleep at all. But after we get used to that noise, by golly, they have to pull the boys out of the bed and drop them on the floor before he could get up and do the work. Otherwise, we take a cold towel and put it on their face to wake them up. And then when we get through in the fall time in the river boat, we could see the earth. Look one place, you could see the trees passing by us, and then we look around and we're on a dry land. It takes over a week before we get used to coming back from the riverboat. And it's not all of that, it took over a week before we could sleep good again, because after that noise, when we go to bed there, we can't go to sleep very well. Finally, we gets out of that. That's all the two troubles we always used to have.
Was your cabin back behind the engine room?
It's right back behind, right in the wall of this, where the buckets are turning. That's boom, 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 you could turn, and the spring bed are usually jumping about 6 inches up, and bang, 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 and some of the boys you could hear, boys sleeping away, just don't know what's going on. And then I always end up, the single boys always end up in the Yukon River, the very last boat. The last boat is always on the, come up to White House on the 25th of October. When we started up from down to Dawson, we run into just a glacier, slush water. Just like ice, you could see it and slush coming down. And the last boat go down to Dawson and back. It was a special boat for that. They had the galvanized iron tins under the boat and so that the slush won't cut it.
What boat was that again?
That was Nesettle.
Nesettle.
Yeah, steamer Nesettle. And we travel about an hour and then we have to tie up, and we tie rope around each other, and then we go down the stern wheel and knock the ice off of the stern wheel and the butt of it, because if not, the paddle might damaged, because it builds right up with ice in 1 hour time. And after we pass Stewart and Big Salmon, then we get away from that slush, and it looks very nice when we're coming up from Teslin River. It looks very nice when we started up from there this way, because we don't see any more slush water till we get to Whitehorse.
You mentioned the bells for signaling the engine room. Can you remember the old system? I know they used the telegraphs after that for a while.
Yeah, they had that other ones after a while, but the other ones you have to jig the pull the big bell. It's at a great big bell and say bang.
And then there was a little bell too.
When it's go, yeah, the jingles they call. And then they had buzzard. They had a buzz bell too. But they used that for emergency, the buzz. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go ahead, the first they ring the buzzer, so the engineer comes and stand by. I watched him a lot of times, the engineer, and then they go ahead and say bang, bang, then they go backwards, and then you give him one jingle, bring, and that means slow. Then you back out, and when you finish, the captain ring the bell again, the big one, bang. And then bang, go ahead, and bring, bring, and then you go slow. And then you turn around, and then you go ahead, then you give him another two times, bring, 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 then go ahead. And then they give it a buzz, they say, then the man, the engineer would answer him on a tube they talk through. He says, okay, we go full speed ahead now, and they go down, then we go down the Yukon River.
Mm-hmm. So the firemen working on the boiler, they'd hear those bells too, eh?
No, mm-hmm. There's none in there. But there is a tube in there that goes from the engineer room to the fireman, and then you heard shh, they whistle and they heard and they come and answer. And then the engineer would say there's steam, it's not right, the steam is too low. So the firemen, well, they have to stoke it up and try to get more steam. A lot of places in the fall time of the year we have to use cable to line the boat. There's only two places that I know we used to use the line. One at the, three rather. One at Hell's Gate, we have to follow the channel that they had the bucket down there, and they dig a hole. It's just a place where the sand come right up. And, you can put your weight all the way across the Yukon River, there, but it's about a mile wide, I think it was. And if you jump overboard in that, if you happen to... If you happen to jump overboard...
I'll stop it.
Yeah, if there's for any reason that the fellow would jump overboard, they can sink right in the gravel, in the sand, because it's just a quicksand-like all the way across. So there was an old captain, used to be, he's an in-native guy. I forgot his name. He used to have a winch down there with a bucket, and he used to clean the whole place, and then he, every time the boat going down or coming up, he gets in the boat and he knows where it is and he follows it up. We have no trouble in there. But when that thing is closed up on a low water in the fall time, we have to line in there. That's a Hell's Gate. And then another one we come to, they call it a rink. Mm-hmm. Rink Rapids. That place too, we have to do line in the fall time of the year.
Did you go, when you went up past the rink, did you go close to the shore where the wreck of the...
Yeah, we go right close to that.
Yeah.
You go right close to that. And then when we pass that, and then the last one going upstream is Five Fingers. In the summertime, when the high water, it's smooth, everything is smooth. But in the fall time, when the water is low at this time of year, there's about a foot drop on the lower side. There's a kind of rim across, and the water running over it leaves a shoulder in there. That's why they have a cable in there. And after September, they have to line every time they come up in there. And the lining of the cable, I don't know if it's there yet, the cable, it's on the left-hand side of the, on the wall of the Five Finger Rapids. And we have to use pipe pole to pick that up, and we have to be quick about it and make three turns around the winch. And of course, where's Taku? They have to call for Taku to go on the winch, and I look after that.
So that, how big a cable was that, about 1 inch?
That's an inch cable in there. Mm-hmm. It might be a little over an inch, because I noticed it was pretty good size winch. I mean, a pretty good size cable. And when in the fall time, they used to bring that cable up out of the water, and it's have to be greased for the next year so that it don't get rust.
But it was still probably a dirty thing to handle, eh?
Oh, it is.
If you'd use gloves? You must have gloves?
Oh, yeah. Even gloves you use, it's kind of awkward, because some of the strands, little strands, would be busted and stick out like a porcupine quilt on you. It goes right through the mittens. It's got to be heavy mittens to use for that.
Yeah. Yeah, the loggers call those little things jaggers.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what we call it, too. But
the same word, eh?
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Jaggers.
That's interesting. But when you were picking up the cables, you fish for it with a pike pole and you got it aboard.
Yeah.
You just wrap it right around the nigger
right
head.
Right away. You got to wrap it around the right way too.
Mm-hmm.
You got to wrap it around the right way. The one that's upstream is going to be on top of the winch, and then they're down like that. So when the winch is coming this way, well, it's pulling it. Sometimes the other fellas, they don't know, they put it the other way, and then, of course, a little tip there, he would be jumping up and down in there. By the time you learn that, you boneheads.
So you would go around over the top?
Yes.
And around, you make three wraps and then come off?
Yeah.
And then when as it comes off, you throw it over the side again?
Yeah, you got to throw it over the side again.
You didn't leave it,
The captain give you a signal to drop it. Beep, beep, and okay, drop it then.
You have to move pretty fast to get out of the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't move myself, but the other fellas have to move. But me, I'm right behind a winch. I have to duck under and watch from the side. Because one time the winch bust, and it come like a whip, and it just hit the front end of the boat there, and you could see just like a saw went through there right down. They say one fella get killed with the winch there one time, and I don't know when it was, they didn't tell me when. The poor fella, his head was split right in two. You got to watch that. You have to be watching. And it's got to be a man that know how what steam and how much to feed the steam to the winch. Otherwise, you go too fast and the mate wouldn't get a chance to tell you to slack off sometimes. The mate always put his feet on it, and a lot of times I could hear the winch coming at the cable, like making noise, bing, 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 just like violin string.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I got to watch what I'm doing, and of course the mate shows, go ahead, keep it going ahead. Sometimes I'll only holler at him and say, you can't take it. Mm-hmm. And finally one time I did holler at him. I said, gee, I says, it's pretty bad now. I said, I'll give him everything what he got now. He said, keep turning, bang, the thing went.
This is side two of tape one, November 3rd, 1978. Johnny, you were just, before we stopped there, the tape ran out, you were just explaining how this cable just broke.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, of course, Tip, he was giving me to go ahead, and I give every steam it could take, and you could hear the cable singing away just like as if you're tuning up a violin, bing, 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 and finally it left right off of the river and was straight towards the beach. There were the biggest tree that there was tied. There was three hitch we had on the trees. And finally, all at once, bang, away it went. The three of them trees gave away, not the cable. The cable didn't break. But all the three of them cable, the trees, they jumped from where on the side hill where it was. They jumped from there, and it was one-third of the way across the river. It poured right in there. And then the river, that thing drift down. And the men that were handling the cable was pretty slow with it, and finally I had to give it a go ahead on them, and the winch went brrr, just like that, ticking up everything we can. And finally we got a hold of it, and we had an awful time to bring that thing up against the river with them tree and them trees tied to it. And some of the guys says we should have cut the cable, but the little Tip says, no way, he says, we're going to take that off. When it come up, there was no chainsaws and nothing. But when it came up, we had to use, the first tree come inside, we had to use a saw, a cross-cut saw. They cut that in two before we released the cable out of it. And we keep doing it until we get the three of them thing loose. So that's how strong the cable is, and what kind of trouble we go through when we get stuck on the river.
But when the trees were uprooted, the boat had started to drift back downstream.
No, No.
They just held it there?
That's when it was on a sandbar. We had to...
Oh, I see.
We had to, this cable across the river to try to pull the boat out. But there was one mistake that he did. There was a back current, and man, the back current was against the barge, because the barge side, it's not round like the boat, it's straight up and down. And when the current hitting that thing, it's an awful pressure that held that thing up in there. By releasing the barge out a little, then the outer current took the other side of the barge, and that's how we got out of there. After 36 hours on the barge.
Oh, I see. Yeah. But you say you went one time. You went down the river as far as Circling. What was that, a freight trip then from Dawsondale?
Yeah, it was a from Dawsondale. It was a freight trip going down, and then they got a go ahead at the Yukon. Something went wrong with the buckets in the back, and they couldn't come up the river. So the carpenters are working on that down. So we load up the steamer Exceller in Dawson, took the freight to Midham and the mail, all that thing. So every one of us was wishing that we go all the way down to the Solchuk, but happened to be at Circler. That's where we met him. We had to unload in there, and then we come back. And of course, then we load up in Dawson, and then we come on back up to Whitehorse.
Did you ever work on the boiler? Did you ever work as a fireman?
No.
But when you stopped for wood, everybody got involved in that, eh? Everybody.
Oh, yeah, everybody involved, except the second officer. But from the the third season, the deck boy, I don't know what he'd done, or he got laid off. I think he's fired, but he said he was laid off. And I took his job up on top. I got 8 hours a day to work then. And I was shining the doorknobs and shining the blast buttons on a captain and engineer and steward's uniform and the mates. And I was washing the deck upstairs, and I was doing all that stuff and taking wood up to the pilot house. And 8 o'clock in the evening, 5 o'clock, I'm off the job until 8 o'clock the next morning. Until Malcolm McCauley gets sick, and he took me in his place for the time being, and I stayed on that half a season. And then the next season, I put here, finish it off. The reason I quit that job was because my brother Henry and we call him brother anyway, Tom Williams, they find a mineral down the Taco River at the Tulsico area. And they're going back down there to claim it, to stake it. And they ask me if I want to make good money, and they ask me if I can go down there and do some staking. So I did. I give my mate the notice that I'm going to a certain date. It was about 30 days, I guess it was, that I was going to quit and I'm going to Athens, and he asked me why. So I tell him there's some mineral stake, the mineral they find down there, and they asked me if I want to come down with them to do some staking. And of course, little Tippy told me, he says, I didn't, don't blame you at all. He says, if you get good luck to do some staking there, you might make a pile of money there. So I did. But there was only one mistake that, as usual, a fellow named George Bacon is an Englishman, and he know Tom Williams well. And when he saw Tom Williams in June, Alaska, he's got a rock in his hand, and he asked him where that thing come from. And he told me, find this thing. So he went and started treating the Indian there with some whiskey. And when old Tom Williams there, he was under the confluence of a liquor, that he asked him where he'd come from. And Tom Williams said, oh, that's easy. He says, I won't have no trouble to go back and find it. In Tulsico, I braced a tree, and my name and Henry, and my cousin Henry's name on it. too. That's what it is. And by golly, when Tom Williams went to Adam after he tell him what it was, George Bacon took three other boys with him. They went up then. They saw this brace tree and the name on it, and they went straight back up and prospect around. They find that thing, and they stake it all up. So when we get back down there in September, by golly, we were out of luck. Of course, we had miner's license, and we had tax for stakes and all that thing. That didn't do us any good because there's no place for us to put any stake. And George Bacon, I understand that he sold a whole area there to the company for $250,000. And we had to stay down Taku River there for the winter. All we get out of that was 250 beaver with Mars 4 of us and some fur, a little fur beside that. And at that time, the best price we can get for beaver was $9, mm-hmm. down to $1. And the marten, the best price we get was $7. And the best dark marten was $14. I sold an otter there for $2.50. That's how low the price of the fur was.
Yeah, it was bad. It just started to get bad then.
But still, all in all, when I come back from there, there wasn't any, the fur was no good at all up till about, around 40. Then they start picking up. Mm-hmm. And the best part of the stuff that the women's make money on was moccasins. Since there was a war at the Aleutian Islands, they buy a lot of babiche for snowshoes and the fine fillings, and a lot of mittens, moccasins, so that the friars and so that the people, soldiers, use that. Mm-hmm. That's where the Indian women make a lot of money.
Now, you were in Telegraph Creek then from about 1930 on, were you?
Yeah, from 1930 on, I was in Telegraph Creek area up to the 52.
Mm-hmm. And you say you worked one summer or just made one trip then, down the Stikine to Wrangell?
Yeah, well, that's during the war.
Oh, yeah.
It was around 1940. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was 1940, 42. There's a fella, the boat came up, to Telegraph Creek, and the mate there fall down and they twist his leg and was out of joint. So the captain was on that boat, it was Hazel B number 3, mm-hmm. and the smallest boat they had, I think it was number 3 or number 2. And a fellow from Telegraph Creek, he used to run the Yukon, the Dease River, Ernest Marion, which is alive, he's still in Good Hope Lake. Mm-hmm. He was running one of the Barrington's boat down the Stikine River, right to Wrangell. And the only available man was, it was me, and I went down with him for one trip. And when I get down to Wrangell, this fella got off, and then they put another man out from Wrangell because that boat company is from the Alaska. And when I got back to the Telegraph Creek, I got off the boat. It's just a matter of one trip that I had down there.
Hmm. How did you find the Stikine compared to the Yukon River? Was it a little smaller?
It is a little smaller, and it was late in the fall when we make this trip there. One place there was about 12 hours there before we find a little channel to go through. It's a tunnel boat they had.
Oh, yeah.
It's a tunnel boat.
Gas boat.
Yeah. And they got the hatch there that the Radwood shaft is. We couldn't make headways very well, so we opened this hatch. And we find one of the prop break out. I think we hit a rock. and they got two props and extra ones, so we took that one off, and I was a smaller man than the other fella, so I'm the one that reached my hand. It was very cold working in the water in the fall time of the year, and I finally got the prop loose, and then we had to use jack to take it out because it kind of rusted in like. Then we'll put another one on, then we'll went ahead, we done well.
You had to use a jack to get the propeller off the shaft?
Yeah, there's a little jack, a special made jacks for that. They put it right on, and there's a kind of a ringer on it, and they push it right off, and you get it off. When you put the string on it, you have to take something like a pin that you put it in behind the prop, and it's just a matter of a few little taps, and it comes right off.
Yeah, it's like a taper, eh?
Yeah. It's taped off, the shaft is taped off, but when it stay on in the season, it get kind of rust in, like it. When you put the jack in there behind it, and you take this pin and you put it there, one way or the other, and give it a few. It don't take a big hammer neither, and it don't take a very much force. With all that jack stringed on it, and bang, at the weight, it jumps right off. But we have to tie rope around so we don't drop that overboard. When that thing jumps off.
Yeah, I was wondering, is how the propeller, was it too big for one man to pick up?
No. It's well, in a place like that, it is. But when the rope tied around it like that, another man hang onto it, and then you sling it out of there, and then. When you do put it back down, you got to put it down the right way because there is a pin in there that, and there is a slot in the prop there where the pin could go.
Yeah.
And you got to put it on the right way, then you won't have trouble getting on it. Then you use the jack, it works the other way. You put the thing around and then you have it on and you keep tapping it a little at a time till you get it in place. After an hour run or so, we have to open it up again and tighten up the nut on that prop. It have to take a turn again after an hour run. Now we got to make very sure that thing is on, otherwise it might twist the vibration might twist the shaft. There is a shaft. They get some two other shafts in the boat. For in the case of emergency. Oh, I got quite an experience out of the gas boat and river boats too, and all that.
Well, do you remember when they built the that special little gas sternwheel boat that they used on the Dease River in 1940? I think they brought Frank Slim up, or 1941. They brought Frank Slim down in there to take that boat down to Lower Post?
Yeah, that's the sternwheeler.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sternwheeler.
You didn't go on that trip, eh?
No. But I was a swamper doing some freighting between Telegraph Creek and Dease Lake for old man, what was his name now? Fred Appleyard. Fred Appleyard got 5-ton truck that time. And that's where I learned to drive.
Oh.
One would get a...
On that road to Telegraph Creek?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good place to learn to drive.
Well, first of all, that we went to Dease Lake with him. We done some job work in there. We built a kind of a freight shed in there for him. And he got that small car there, a Chevrolet. And it's kind of a Beetle shape with a tape down, something like Volkswagen shape behind. And the Indians in Telegraph Creek call it in Tahltan language, they call it Tso'kala. So that means a Beetle. It's shaped like a Beetle. We went to Telegraph Creek and we went over the Dease Lake and we work on this freight shed. And coming back, old Fred, he was sleepy, so he told me, he says, too bad you can't drive. But I used to drive that old Chevrolet, the first half a ton Chevrolet in Athlin, sawmill, just in the area of the sawmill. I had no driver's license, but There's no law against it. There's just in the yard of the sawmill to run that thing. That's where I really first learned to drive. That was that old Chevrolet back in 1927.
Hmm.
So Fred Appleyard, when we're going back from Dease Lake on this car, he told me, it's too bad that you can't drive. Well, I said, I could drive, but I got no driver's license. Well, tick over then, he said, I want to sleep. And by God, I drove the first thing, that's the little Chevrolet I drove from Dease Lake right into Telegraph Creek. But he told me that before we get into town, if I'm still asleep, he says, woke me up. But I was very careful. I was only covering 30 miles an hour and 25, because at that time the road was so narrow. Some place, if you meet a car, you have to back up for plenty a mile before the other fella could go by.
Mm-hmm.
But right today, right now, you can go 40, 50 miles an hour on that road.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough for, they could have two lanes. They have two lanes in it now instead of one.
But there's still some places on it that are
yeah, it is.
Really rough.
It is, yeah. Yeah, that's when I used to run back and forth with Fred that time, it was around 1942 or 43, I think it was, when they building that boat down the Sticky Beast River. They built two tunnel boats and this other one here, what you call that, a sternwheeler. That's when Frank Slim took it down the Yukon River, down the Dease River, right into, what do you call it?
Lower Post.
And everybody was saying that, by golly, said that Captain Frank Slim, he sure know how to handle that boat. Well, I told him, I said, he should know how to handle it. He said, I tell him that he haven't got the name, but they used to call him Captain Frank Slim. But he used to run the boat in the Yukon River, and he used to run that, what do you call, loon.
Mm-hmm.
The loon is the one he used to run. It's the one that's still on the Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
That's the boat he run with on the barge. So I know him when he was running it down the Liard River, the Dease River.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently they had quite a time on that river because it's so narrow and fast.
Yeah. And not only that, it gets pretty dry. All the material that came to the airport, it came all the way up the coast from Vancouver to Wrangell, and then up the Wrangell, and to Telegraph Creek, and then over the Portage, and then the Dease River Lake, and down the Dease River into the Lower Post.
Yeah. Hmm. That road was from Telegraph Creek to Dease Lake. That was built when the first time you went to Telegraph Creek, eh?
Yes, it was built. It was an old pack train road.
Mm-hmm.
The pack horses used to go through there, but some places it was chopped open wide enough. There was an old car, Chevrolet, I think it was. Now they call it the chicken car. It's in Telegraph Creek yet. It's old.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack McDonald, that was Mrs. George Ball's brother. He's the one that brought that thing in. And Freddie Lou Dicker and him used to go to. At that time, it was 1928, 29 up to 30th. And when I was in Telegraph Creek, 32. I still see Captain Jack McDonald and Walter Lou Dicker Carlick, that they're running back and forth with the freight for the Lake House, they call this store. I think his name was Reed, something like Reed, this fellow that owned the store there at that time, beside the Hudson Bay. But the Hudson Bay freight used to go there with the pack train.
Mm-hmm.
And finally they chopped the road open, and what they call old man Hope and Marion, old man Glenn Hope and Mr. Marion, A.J. Marion, they had a tractor They had a tractor, and they had two wagons. They had tractor train that run the freight over there. And the road is so bad, some places when the train gets stuck, the axles go right to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's muddy. So the government stepped in, they gravel the places like that, and some places there'd be corduroy bridges in there. And Jack McDonald, it took him sometimes 2 weeks to make one load of trip to the East Lake with the truck. And
you'd do better walking.
And he had Walter Ludeke working for him for $1 a day, that's all. And finally, the government start building the road, the same pack train road, and they start graveling it. The only the place they gravel was where the wheels go on, and they don't further gravel the whole length of the road, just where the wheels are.
Mm-hmm.
It was graveled, and yet all in all, it takes a week to make the trip to Dease Lake and back. And some good dry weather, it took one day to do it. But the rainy weathers in the fall like this, it took a week, sometimes 2 weeks to get out in and out of that place.
Hmm.
Until the construction outfit came in, the one that's when the freight going into Lease Lake for the airport. At that time, a fellow named Bob Rome, that fellow died here recently. He was the man that was looking after the construction outfit. There was about 12 5-ton trucks came into Telegraph Creek, and graders and the earth removers and all that thing, and they took over
mm-hmm.
the road and the gravel. That's when they upgrade the road all the way through. But still, all in all, it had to be a very good winter because it's nothing but the clay.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever there is a weather like this time, fall time, they had an awful time, and they can't hold the cars on the road. It's and at that time it's just only one lane all the way right through to Lease Lake. But when the construction outfit got a hold of it, ever so far on, they make a side road there, so if they meet one another, they can mm-hmm. back into there, and they don't want to go by. During the war over there, there were 16 construction trucks on Telegraph Road, and then three of A.J. and Hope and Marion's truck on the road, and one was Pat Collison had one 5-ton on the road, and Fred Appleyard had two trucks on the road. So the most of it is around 20 trucks on that road that time, and everyone was very, very busy.
Hmm. Hauling through to Dease Lake.
Yeah.
During the 30s, did a number of prospectors go into that Dease Lake country, the Turnagain and all that?
Oh yeah, there's always that prospectors come.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly one fellow that I remember used to come even to Attleny used to come. From a fellow from Ketchikan, I forgot the name of him though. He used to go all through and basically prospecting. And then there's a lot of more the prospectors come there, which is pretty grub stake, but some of them grub stake by the Hudson Bay Company,
mm-hmm.
and all sorts of stuff like that.
Hmm. Did any of them go trapping?
No. One of them did. But I don't know what if he's alive yet. I got his picture on a white horse down here, a fellow named, he always called himself King George Male. He lived with an Indian woman in Telegraph Creek, and they moved him out, he's an American guy, they moved him out of Telegraph Creek because he was about 90 some odd years old. And his nephew, his nephew's wife took him down to see California.
Hmm. Well, you must have known George Dalzell pretty well, eh?
I know George Dalzell pretty well.
He was in a bit of trouble with the police there in late 30s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know all about that, too. He always bring in hunters from outside.
Yeah.
And I think it was from Kitchikan, he brought a hunter in, and I don't know how exactly, I don't know much about it, but this is just as much as I know what I say, that they went and he got a sheep. I think it was from Kitchikan, his hunter. And he flew over the country, over the top of the, and took the head out, sheep head out, and the policeman caught up with him, and they ground him.
Oh, I see.
So that's how he was ground.
Yeah.
And they told him that he had to fly the rescue plane from Watson Lake, and whenever the war is over, he's going to get his license back. So he did. He'd rather do that to keep the record on trainer flying, I think. So he was on a rescue plane from Watson Lake until the war is over. Then he get his regular commercial license back.
Yeah, I see.
But he's been doing a lot of trapping and all that. I think the policeman been laying for him. Whenever he go to Wrangell, Alaska, he used to go to the beer parlor gather a bunch of cigarette empty boxes, and then he come back to a lower post, and then he fly around all over where the Indian trap line. When he make sure nobody around there, he clean up the beaver around there, the big ones, and then he fry. When he fry away from there, he throw those American cigarette empty packages all over the place. And when the owner, the trap line owner, come along and he see American people been poaching on his trap line, and that's what happened. So they never caught up to him on that part, but they knew it was him that's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then lately, not very long ago, the conservation officer here, Baldwin, he went and caught up with him. In East Lake, they opened the house and they took the wolf skins out, and there were shotgun marks on the back of the wolves. And so they charged him for that, because that wolf's been shot in the back with from an airplane. Mm-hmm. And they got, he's got a sawed-off shotgun, and that's what he was using. He flew over the wolves and he shot them from the back, but nobody see him doing it, and there was no proof.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time that Baldwin had the conservation officer break into his house at Beast Lake, and I don't know how he got away with it. He was going to charge him with breaking in with it. And at the same time that Baldwin went down there to Watson Lake and questioned Dalzell down there, but Dalzell's lawyer says that he was questioned in the Yukon site, so they can't do nothing on their BC side about it. So he lost the Baldwin lost the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was a newcomer, this Baldwin here, and I guess he don't know much what to do about them things, but now I think he's all right. He's doing things right, because I see the last time I see Baldwin had a dog there training for to catch, to get to, if there was any car, some cargo by you and all that, the dog stick his head off in the back and he get the scent of a blood or something, and they start barking as you go back and catch this guy up, and he do get them too.
Hmm.
Yeah, he get them.
Hmm. Where's he live then?
He's in, I think he's in Smithers now.
Yeah.
And some of the white fellows see the dog running around at large, and he told them that they said that if it's a regular registered police dog, and if it's not registered police dog, that dog is going to be missing someday. And by God.